So I'd like to take a couple of minutes to introduce the topic of our panel, to give an overview of how we're going to address it in terms of who's talking when. And then I'd like to introduce our two panelists who are here with me today. My name's Barbara Smith. I'm the head of the St. Louis chapter of the Federalist Society, and I have the honor of moderating this panel with two wonderful participants who've agreed to participate today. To give you an overview, the topic of this panel is litigation on abortion restrictions post-Dobbs. And the idea of the panel is that Dobbs itself returned the question of whether and to what extent we should regulate the provision of abortion services to the states. And so states like Missouri have opted to have a more restrictive regime that prohibits or severely restricts access to abortion. Other states with different values have taken the opposite tract and have allowed abortion in all or almost all cases. And the question that we want to address today is, what does litigation challenging abortion regulation look like in a post-Dobbs world? What avenues are left open for the courts to answer questions about abortion legislation or regulations or other restrictions? So that's the universe of the subject matter of our panel today. Obviously, in the tradition of the Federalist Society, not taking a position on whether restrictions on abortions are positive or negative, but just evaluating what the law looks like and what lawsuits look like going forward in a post-Dobbs world. In terms of format of the panel today, I will introduce our two panelists, and then I will give each of them 5 to 7 minutes to provide some opening remarks on whatever they'd like to discuss within the scope of our panel. And then we've, as a panel, have talked about three questions that they're going to address related to this topic that I hope we can get through. And at the conclusion, we'd like to leave some time for audience questions. So if anything you hear today sparks a question in your mind about any of these issues, we'd love to hear from you at the end. So that's how we are planning to proceed. I'll start with Andy Hirth, who's to my left. He's the founding partner of TGH Litigation, a civil rights firm in Columbia. He previously served as deputy general counsel to Missouri Attorney General Chris Koster. He was an associate in the Appellate and Supreme Court Practice Group, which is the best practice group at every firm. But in his case at Jenner and Block in Chicago, and he clerked for Judge Lowry on the Western District of Missouri. Andy graduated from the University of Missouri Columbia School of Law in 2005, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Missouri Law Review and founding president of the Mizzou chapter of the American Constitution Society. He returned to Mizzou in 2016 as an adjunct professor of constitutional law. Andy has argued before the Eastern and Western Districts of the Missouri Court of Appeals, the Missouri Supreme Court, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 8th and 9th Circuits. Jesus Osete, to my right, previously served as general counsel to Missouri Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft and deputy attorney general for special litigation under then Missouri Attorney General, now U.S. Senator Eric Schmidt. He's presented oral argument in the Supreme Court of the United States in a case that was referenced earlier today.
Thanks, Judge Schill.
Jesus clerked for Judge Shepard on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 8th Circuit and then Chief Justice Zell Fisher of the Missouri Supreme Court. He received his law degree from Washington University in St. Louis, where he served as senior executive editor of the Washington University Law Review. Before law school, he worked for the late Senator John McCain in the U.S. Senate and completed his undergraduate studies at the University of Arizona, although we're very happy to have you back in Missouri, so good choice there. That is our introduction today. I'd like to let Jesus start with 5 to 7 minutes of opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you all for being here. I think it's been a very delightful conference. I just want to give a shout out to Jennifer, Lisa, Jana, Mark Ellinger, and everybody else who's put this together. It's taken a lot of effort and a lot of hands to do this. So apologize if I don't mention you directly, but this has been had a lot of people who prefer to be in Colorado in January as opposed to Jeff City, so it's been difficult to get people. So those of you who've actually been here, including myself, I really appreciate that a lot. Judge Shelb was being very nice. He did not mention that I was the advocate who lost that case and got him his first reversal in the U.S. Supreme Court. So I will always remember that the rest of my life, Judge Shelb. The Dobbs decision, there's been a lot of ink spilled and a lot of presentations about what Dobbs did. And obviously the high-level view of Dobbs is that it overruled Roe versus Wade, the holding that there was a substantive due process right to an abortion to terminate a pregnancy. Also overruled the the Casey framework, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which ended up resulting in the undue burden analysis, which I'm sure somebody like Judge Shelp or Limbaugh or somebody else will tell you, it's not always the easiest assessment or analysis to do, very factually heavy. So Dobbs overruled those precedents and got us back to really what is aptly the title of this conference, which is the resurgence of state constitutions and returning the question of abortion to the states, which is what the founders had envisioned some of these issues of health to be. And so what I'd like to talk about is sort of my sort of 5-minute remarks, the post-Dobbs analysis, the post-Dobbs framework. I like to put it into three buckets. So the first bucket is, you know, what kind of legislation and regulatory things are we going to see after Dobbs, in the wake of Dobbs, so to speak. The second will be some of the enforcement challenges that we're going to see with the post-Dobbs world and some of the civil lawsuits that we saw as of yesterday with new and novel constitutional challenges. And then the third bucket is going to be something that my friend Judge Trubisky and Judge Stevens mentioned earlier, which is the direct democracy angle. Are we going to see something on the ballot when it comes to abortion? And I think that's going to be a resounding yes to that question. So the first bucket, I'd mention a couple pieces of legislation. This is probably based on a recent search, I think last night that I double-checked it, but one of the biggest things that's come out of Dobbs is the federal government being a little more aggressive as to what they can do within their authority or arguably their authority to regulate abortion or not regulate abortion and give access to abortion. One of the things you've noticed is that some of these VA facilities in states that have categorically prohibited abortion or with very limited exceptions, they're now allowing the procedure to be performed at VA clinics and VA affiliates. I could see a situation where they potentially get into the spending clause, you know, issue with that, you know, with CMS facilities. That's exactly what happened with the vaccine mandate. You know, if you didn't get the mandate for the employees, you'd lose funding. So I could see an angle there. The FDA, in a giant reversal, is now decided to approve some of these MIF-prone, or I forget what the name is again, but some of these abortion-inducing pills, and allow the delivery of these medications directly to patients and other individuals in states who are located in states that prohibit abortion. The OLC had a quite an astounding reversal legal opinion that came out, I think the day before Christmas Eve, that basically said that federal law does not prohibit the delivery or the manufacture of these abortion-inducing pills. And really they focused on federal law doesn't prohibit the delivery of these medications directly to a state that prohibits abortion. And again, that has not been their position. There's federal law, 18 U.S.C., I think it's 1421 and 1422, that basically don't allow the delivery of abortion-inducing pills. I think you can also, it's prohibited to take and receive non-mailable matters through the Postal Service. So those statutes have been essentially set aside in this OLC opinion. So we'll see what happens. That's led to some Republican AGs, including here in Missouri, to issue a letter basically saying that they're going against the will of Congress. But again, with this administration, again, it's another use of the administrative state through the FDA and through the VA and other places. So that's led to states like Missouri for this upcoming legislative session to propose certain pieces of legislation in response to those administrative decisions by the Biden administration. HB 163, which is currently being sponsored by Brian Seitz, and I believe on the other side by Mike Searpoy, SB 491, is essentially prohibiting or is creating the offense of trafficking abortion-inducing medications and pills. I think there's also provision in there that wouldn't allow the Board of Professional Registration to issue licenses to pharmacies that prescribe these abortion-inducing medications. There's some other, and this kind of ties into the third bucket on the initiative petitions, but there's some SJRs that are being proposed. So last year, Senator Onder and Senator Kagan had proposed Senate Joint Resolution 52 and 53 that basically would mimic what Louisiana's Constitution says, that nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to create a right to abortion. In Kentucky, they tried to do that, but it failed resoundingly with this latest wave of referendums and legislation that happened in August and November. But Louisiana does have that on the books, and I think they're trying to do the same with Missouri, because the concern is that if they can't do it legislatively, if they can't do it through a constitution, then again, tying to the theme we talked about earlier, you know, what's stopping five members of this Supreme Court, or four in this case, from doing like something like my friend Eddie with the state of Kansas, where you do recognize a right to abortion in the state constitution through penumbras and privacy and what else. Iowa is obviously taking a different route with that, but those are some concerns in SJR that would prohibit, basically make the Constitution abortion neutral on these questions. And then the other bucket is the enforcement side. You know, we had a civil lawsuit filed yesterday. Some of these faith-based organizations and religious groups, clergy, that are claiming that not having access to an abortion violates, you know, free exercise clause of the state constitution, or violates the establishment clause, which I think is the argument that's being put forward in this latest lawsuit. And this has to do with the 188 statute that has now gotten back on the books in Missouri after the Roe v. Wade decision was overruled. So that'll be interesting. You know, that's the religious angle. It's a similar lawsuit that was brought a couple of years ago in the Missouri Supreme Court and the Eighth Circuit, where they rejected a federal establishment clause claim. So I don't really see where that's going, but it's an argument, I suppose. And then you also have, obviously, you know, criminal liability with this new statute, 188. I think Andy will correct me, but I think the statute has a medical emergency exception, but it does not have an exception for rape or incest or other health of the mother, some of the traditional exceptions that are in other states. So the question is, you know, if somebody's actually going to bring an enforcement action under that, what kind of affirmative defenses can be raised in those contexts? Is it a true medical emergency? Is it even constitutional? Those are some of the things that might be teed up for some of the courts. And then finally, just to end my brief remarks here, the IP process. So if all else fails, as the theme has been, you know, earlier this morning, there'll be some sort of initiative petition filed that essentially confers a right to abortion. There's been one filed so far by a citizen out of Columbia, but he decided to file his initiative petition, I think, in August of last year. And there's a case out of the Missouri Supreme Court that says you have to wait until the day after the last election cycle to file. So he brought a mandamus against Secretary Ashcroft's office and lost, obviously, in that case. And that's now pending on appeal. But essentially, if my understanding is, there are two provisions that he's proposing. One is to amend the statute to have a rape or incest provision, and two, to basically allow Missourians to have access to FDA-approved abortion-inducing medications. But beyond that, no, there has not been another initiative petition that I'm aware with. But as you probably know, I think in the last 2 weeks, the Secretary of State's office has received about 50 of these initiative petitions already. And as my friend Mr. Grime knows, you know, with that kind of initiative petition work, there's the pre-election stuff, which is getting the ballot title right, the fair summary language. You know, there's litigation about that that's quite quite expeditious. But then afterwards, there's post-election contests, and as my friend Mr. Ellinger will tell you, after the Dotson versus Kander case, that's essentially gotten out of control. I think Quinn Lucas recently had an election contest filed over the Amendment 4 bill that is basically mandating that the city of Kansas City increase its funding for police. So that's what I anticipate happening with the IP front once they do get proposed. I think they'll get proposed sometime later this year, but as somebody said earlier, if they have $3 million, they'll probably get it passed. So we'll see what happens. But I think those are some of my reflections so far on Dobbs. Thank you.
Andy?
Thanks, Barbara, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to be here today. This is fourth or fifth Federalist Society event that I've been invited to be the voice of reason at. and it's always a pleasure, I think, to engage in dialogue with people that disagree with you. And so I'm really happy to be here today, and I'm grateful for that opportunity. Just in terms of opening remarks, I think there are three things that struck me about the Dobbs decision that I was going to briefly address, which may not be the most obvious points, but are, I think, something that we'll see a lot more of. One is is the single paragraph, maybe it's two paragraphs, in Justice Alito's majority opinion devoted to equal protection challenges, essentially dismissing those arguments, saying we've already ruled that regulation of pregnancy is not regulation based on sex, and therefore there's no heightened scrutiny for laws that apply to or that regulate abortion. That sole paragraph seems to beg the question to me, and I think we'll see a lot of arguments raised in the future regarding equal protection. For example, I mean, is it possible, could you have a law that prohibits certain kinds of employment for people who are pregnant, at least under Gdulgig versus Aiello, which is the case that Justice Alito cites, that is subject only to rational basis review. Curious whether if that will actually hold if that comes up in future litigation. The other two points about Dobbs that I wanted to raise actually come from the other opinions, from concurring opinions. In Justice Thomas's concurrence, he notes, I think rightly, that the decision overturning Roe versus Wade opens up a lot of questions about all of the precedent leading to that. Several people have suggested, oh, we're not going after Griswold, we're not going after these other substantive due process cases. I don't personally see any principled basis for distinguishing them. If there is no substantive due process right in this area, it's hard to see why there would be one in terms of contraception or in terms of some of the other places where we've seen substantive due process rulings. So I think Justice Thomas is right that those questions are going to be opened up. The interesting thing there, I think, is in terms of majority support within the country, some of those positions may be very unpopular, and so I'm curious to see what happens with that that kind of litigation in the future. The third point is from Justice Kavanaugh, who indicated that there may be litigation surrounding bills in various states about regulating the right to travel, or that essentially implicate the right to travel. A number of years ago, back when I clerked for Judge Lowry, there was briefly a case on the books here in Missouri. It was subsequently repealed, but that statute made it a tort to aid or assist, cause aid or assist a minor to obtain an abortion without parental consent, regardless of whether parental consent is required in the jurisdiction where the abortion is obtained. And this raised a number of questions, we thought, about speech, for example. As a lawyer, people call me all the time for advice, and if a minor calls me and says, so my parents won't let me have an abortion, is there anything I can do? And if I say, well, you don't need parental consent in Illinois, am I aiding or assisting someone in getting an abortion without parental consent? In that case, Judge Lowry abstained under Pullman abstention, saying that this was a question that had implications under the First Amendment, that the state court could limit the interpretation of the law to not implicate speech, and therefore she abstained to let the state court make that decision. I believe there was a similar challenge in front of Judge Atwell in Kansas City, but I think the law may have been repealed before he ruled. I don't actually remember that. That's what happened or not. But I think we're going to see more things like that. That was a speech issue, but I think there are broader implications about whether, you know, for example, the state of Missouri could make it a crime for a resident of Missouri to obtain an abortion elsewhere and then come back to Missouri. Could someone be punished here? And the Missouri law very clearly says that the woman on whom the abortion is performed cannot be charged with conspiracy. So in our statute right now, that's not allowed. But you can imagine a scenario in which more and more increasingly restrictive legislation was passed where something like that might be become part of the law. And then we'll have questions about whether that interferes with the right to travel. If Missouri has has a power to regulate its citizens for conduct that occurs elsewhere. When we were talking sort of about planning this program, I think Jesus actually mentioned this, but there is a case before the U.S. Supreme Court right now about pigs, which you wouldn't think necessarily would have anything to do with this topic today. But the National Pork Producers case is about whether a state has the authority to regulate extraterritorially. And this issue is sort of near and dear to me. When I was at the Attorney General's office, we actually brought a suit against the state of California based on the same law, except it was about eggs, in that case, not about pork. Unfortunately got kicked out on standing, and so we didn't get to an issue on the merits. I'm curious to see what the Supreme Court does with national pork producers on this issue. But I think we're going to see a lot of these kinds of fights about, we have a very strongly, sharply divided country on this issue in particular, and very much so between different states. And I think we're going to start to see some legal fighting among the states about where one state's ability to protect its citizens runs up against another state's ability to legislate what happens to its citizens. So I think those are some interesting issues we're gonna see in the future.
Well, as the resident pregnant person on our panel, I will reject the pork producers comparison for now. although I do think that the questions you raised about travel and aiding and abetting in particular are good, and I'd like to get to those in a moment. But if we could start talking a little more concretely in the context of civil litigation, so setting aside, Jesus, the important comments you offered about, you know, federal regulatory options or state regulatory options, specifically focusing on what we might see in terms of civil litigation, how do you think these challenges to more restrictive regimes like the one we have in Missouri will be framed? Do you think, for example, as you suggested, Andy, that there's any daylight to bring an equal protection challenge under the federal constitution, as was suggested on the panel earlier today? are those equal protection or due process-based claims better rooted in state constitutional provisions? Are there other federal or state provisions of the Constitution, whether RFRA, and Jesus, I know you mentioned the RFRA Establishment Clause challenge that was being brought, that could be successful? And finally, I know we've seen in the academic literature that perhaps a woman could bring a 13th Amendment-based challenge to a state regulation that required her to carry a pregnancy she didn't want to term. So I guess that's a little bit of suggestion there in the question itself, but pick whichever of those strings you like. What do you think the worthwhile or potentially successful challenges to Missouri's law could look like? And Andy, I'm happy to start with you if you'd like to kick it off.
Sure. I do think, personally, I think the most likely challenge to have any success ultimately would be an equal protection challenge or something along those lines, simply because I think the world has changed a lot in the last 50 years in terms of, for example, the number of women in Congress, the number of women on the bench, the number of women on the Supreme Court. I think we'll see some perhaps different perspectives now than, you know, were possible 50 years ago. I think the religious-based challenges I find particularly interesting. Also, while I was at the AG's office, I defended Missouri's 72-hour waiting period for an abortion against a challenge by the Satanic Temple. Very interesting. I took to calling my opposing counsel the devil's advocate. it was actually a fairly interesting case. The young woman who was the plaintiff argued that the 72-hour waiting period and the literature that she was provided and the things that the doctor was required to tell her 72 hours in advance violated her own religious beliefs. She brought that challenge under the state RFRA, which is pretty expansive. There are not a whole lot of cases on it, but at least in terms of its written, it's very broad and pretty favorable to the plaintiff. The case didn't go anywhere, which wasn't that surprising to me, but I think there are going to be better and better versions of that same argument we're going to see. The case that was just filed 3 days ago here.
Yesterday
in Missouri is a challenge based on three provisions of the Missouri Constitution. It's essentially an Establishment Clause challenge, but at the state level. And it cites in the petition a number of statements by legislators who voted for or who were the sponsors of the current restrictions in Missouri, arguing that their motivation in passing that law was pretty clearly sectarian in nature. I don't know that that argument's really going to go anywhere, but I think it's going to be a pretty interesting one, especially given the very expansive view the U.S. Supreme Court has taken in RFRA-like cases or challenges to legislation based on. Does my voice cut out when I turn over here? It seems like it gets softer to me. Because of some of those decisions and the the breadth with which those decisions have been interpreted, I think we're going to see more challenges on religious grounds. Perhaps the most interesting one, though, and I think Barbara alluded to this, is the 13th Amendment challenge. And this is one that is only really found in the academic literature right now, and I think it tends to get kind of scoffed at by people when they first hear it. But let me frame it this way. Missouri does not have an exception for rape or incest. If you are a woman, you are raped, you get pregnant against your will, and under the current law, there is no basis for you, there is no argument for you to argue that you should not be forced into labor, forced to carry this child to term. I think particularly in the rape and incest setting or situation, the 13th Amendment argument, which the 13th Amendment, as you know, outlawed all slavery and all vestiges of slavery in the United States. Well, of course, you know, prior to the 13th Amendment, enslaved woman who became pregnant, her unborn child was the property of the enslaver. And so there's a parallel argument here that if you are pregnant against your will and forced to carry that child to term, is that not a vestige of slavery? Are you not in that same position? That argument is less appealing in, you know, outside of the rape and incest area, but I think that's an argument that we may see, especially in states like Missouri that don't have an exception for rape or incest.
Awful. Thank you. Jesus, what do you think?
It always amazes me what law professors can come up with for arguments. So, you know, picking up on the religious liberty claim and the Establishment Clause claim. So there was a case, I alluded to it earlier, that Andy defended when he was at the AG's office. It was brought by the Satanic Temple, and essentially it was the whole framework that, you know, in Missouri there's a 72-hour waiting period, there's some literature that, you know, you have the opportunity to see, you have to be given the opportunity to see, and all you're doing is certifying that you had the opportunity to read the literature. And basically, you know, there are all these things about value judgments that the state of Missouri has made through its laws and printed in literature that somebody has the opportunity to read. The opportunity to hear the heartbeat, because at that point, I think they're at 6 weeks or whatnot. And that's something else that the woman can do as part of Missouri's requirements. But all of that was challenged. It was the same plaintiff's attorney out of New Jersey. He's brought similar claims even after Dobbs in Idaho and Mississippi, and I think Wyoming as of last week, where essentially Missouri law, and this goes back to Webster, A.G. Webster, that is, that essentially we have a value judgment in our statutes that says that life begins at conception. And essentially that challenge was to that sentence in that statute on Establishment Clause grounds. And again, the Missouri Supreme Court rejected that argument. Harris versus McRae, some of the other Hyde Amendment cases that came out when Reagan, you know, didn't want to fund abortion with state tax dollars, essentially said just because a value judgment that's manifested through state law coincides with a religious belief doesn't make it an Establishment Clause violation. And Judge Fisher in that case for the Missouri Supreme Court wrote a concurrence where he basically listed all the different statutes that we have on you know, theft and larceny, and basically quoting passages from the Bible, you know, thou shalt not steal and whatnot, shall not lie to your neighbor, etc., and how, you know, look, this is just basically, yes, they're Christian beliefs, other religious beliefs repeat this as well, but just because we've codified into law does not make every law in our criminal code that just happens to coincide with religion somehow an unconstitutional Establishment Clause violation. RFRA is another statute. We have a baby RFRA here in Missouri. It's been hardly used, or at least hardly addressed by the courts. Again, the Missouri Supreme Court briefly addressed it. It was addressed last year in the Baker versus Crossroads Academy case. That was the plaintiff's lawyer out of Kansas, Stillwell, Kansas, who wanted to, I think he had objected to the form that Missouri DHSS uses for exempting little kids from being vaccinated to go to school. And basically he was saying that that form had, you know, violated RFRA. Again, the Court of Appeals in Missouri had rejected that claim. And then I think the Eighth Circuit also rejected a claim where it was the same claim, but a free exercise claim. They brought a hybrid claim between I think it was the telescope case where the same statutory framework violated the free exercise clause of the Missouri Constitution and the federal free exercise clause, again rejected. The lawsuit that was filed yesterday is no different, in my view at least. It boils down to, you know, section 188.10 says that Almighty God is the creator of life, and somehow that violates the Establishment Clause analogs of the Missouri Constitution. So again, following the logic of Doe v. Parson and some of the other cases that have been dealt with by the Missouri courts, federal and state, I really don't see how it has legs, but we'll see what happens. But that's just one sort of subset of claims. Another subset of claims is, you know, as I alluded to earlier, we have an exception for medical emergencies. There's been some debate and some discussion about what that means. When is this an emergency? When is it medical? When is it a medical emergency? And we have doctors who are now potentially going to be held liable for certain things, criminally, that is, because unlike back when Andy was clerking, we no longer have a tort regime where you can, kind of like SB 8 in Texas, where you can sue somebody for who's thinking about getting an abortion to the provider. There was some legislation proposed to that effect, I think, sometime last year, but it didn't go anywhere. And you know, you have to look at all these challenges in a political lens to some extent, because, you know, I mean, look, Republicans did not have the best year in November. There have been a lot of, you know, pointing fingers and a lot of explanations for that. I just don't see the political appetite for doing something like that, for pursuing bounty hunter legislation, for pursuing criminalizing, you know, some of these things in certain counties where it's very likely going to happen. Extraterritoriality concerns are valid. I mean, the case out of California with the pork producers is really chilling, because if, you know, if California says we're not going to allow the consumption of, you know, pigs who didn't have enough room, you know, to gallop or something in Iowa or wherever they're coming from, somehow that's going to violate the, you know, dormant commerce clause. And now we're going to extend that to, you know, cars that are manufactured by illegal immigrants, or they're going to, you know, we're not going to buy clothing that was designed by Black Lives Matter. I mean, we literally have gone back to the balkanization concerns that the founders feared at the Articles of Confederation. So I don't see it happening, but again, it's something that's out there, not something I've seen. But I think the bigger claim that I'm looking at realistically, there's a passage out of the Reproductive Health Services versus Nixon case. This is back in 2006. And at the time, it was essentially a challenge to some of these waiting periods and some of these other regimes that have been in place for a long time. And I think there was a state constitutional due process claim that was brought in that case. And I think the Missouri Supreme Court basically said, although we have the option to read our due process clause in the state constitution much broader than the federal due process clause, we choose not to do so at this time. Now, three of the members that were on that court in 2006 are still on the court, or at least two of them are. I think Judge Russell certainly is still on the court. And so there is a valid concern, I think, that, you know, even if substantive due process, you know, is no longer giving quarter to a right to abortion, you know, what is stopping anybody from doing the same that Justice DeGaulle, you know, objected to in Kansas? And some of the other, you know, folks that were initially in dissent in Iowa did the same thing. I don't see what's stopping them from reading the Constitution the same way. I think there are other concerns that are going to come up, and we've alluded to some of them earlier today with the court plan and with some other political repercussions. But I think the due process concern, whether it's void for vagueness, whether it's overbreath, whether it's something else, or whether it's just, again, you know, adopting a substantive due process claim in Missouri to a right to abortion through the lens of privacy or something else, or whatever the preamble says, bodily integrity, et cetera. I think that's the bigger one to look out for. And I'm surprised it hasn't been filed. Maybe there's some explanation for that. But I think that's probably the biggest one, is that there's going to be a substantive due process claim brought at some point. And I don't think it's going to be in the case yesterday. It's probably going to have to be filed in, you know, Cole County if they bring it against the AG. But I think that's the biggest one to be looking out for. Other than that, these religious liberty claims, these 13th Amendment claims, you know, whatever you want to call them, 9th Amendment claims, you know, whoever wants to bring those, I just don't think there's a lot of leg there for those. I think the due process case is going to be the one to look out for. At least that's the one I'm looking out for.
Yeah, and I would just add to that that the South Carolina Supreme Court 2 or 3 weeks ago, in fact, did that, exactly that, ruled that the state constitution of South Carolina guarantees a right to abortion under its privacy, right to privacy provision. There's an express right to privacy in their constitution, but the state Supreme Court held that that protects a right to abortion.
Jesus, anything else? By the way, Jesus did not miss your reference to baby RFRA, and as we've decided from this morning, words matter, so excellent.
Words matter.
Excellent choice. So our next question, shifting to something Andy alluded to in his opening remarks, and that is Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence specifically. Two questions about that. Are there problems with laws like the one in Missouri that criminalize or otherwise punish citizens who either travel to another state to receive abortion services? So a Missouri woman who goes to Illinois to receive a service that she can't receive in Missouri. Or two, that criminalize or punish people who assist others in doing so. So Andy, I think, had the helpful example of a lawyer who counsels a client about where she could get an abortion. You can obviously think of other examples, whether it's funding, whether it's physically driving someone to another state. Are there problems with laws that would prohibit either of those two things because they interfere with the fundamental right to travel or other provisions of the Constitution, other fundamental rights as we understand them? Jesus, do you want to kick this one off?
Yeah, so I take a more cynical view of, you know, the Kavanaugh concurrence. Really, I think what he was signaling this concurrence is, you know, this is how far I'm going to go. I'm not going to be, you know, recognizing, I'm not going to let legislation, you know, again, regulate extraterritorially, because again, there are principal concerns for that. I think if you allow that to happen, then I think it's going to come back and hit conservatives in California with the Second Amendment. I mean, Gavin Newsom's already said as much, that he's going to essentially propose an SB8 Texas analog in California, where, you know, if you basically can't own a firearm, and if you do, you're going to be civilly liable for this much, et cetera. I just think it comes back and bites us every time. I take a more cynical view because I do think that Kavanaugh sees that there are some issues that are going to come up. And if it's the interstate travel issue, he's going to say, look, maybe Thomas, maybe Gorsuch, maybe Alito are willing to go further than me, but I'm not going that far. And I'm the swing vote. I'm the middle vote, I suppose, is what he's saying in that concurrence. That's my cynical take. The other point, though, that I think is a little more interesting is he does make it very clear that I think, if I recall correctly, he took a position that, you know, there are going to be some real concerns about retroactivity if you try to criminalize someone who, or go after somebody who sought an abortion or got an abortion before the Dobbs opinion was issued. And there's obviously the law nerds in the room will understand the Teague precedents and all the other things about when a precedent is retroactive. But if you ask me, after, you know, Miller versus Alabama and Montgomery versus Louisiana, they basically have expanded that retroactivity test to basically apply to anything. So I don't see how they can go back from the jailwalk cases on that issue. But I think Kavanaugh is basically saying, like, you know, look, you're not going to be going after people who got an abortion 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And again, I have to always bring up the political lens because I don't see the political appetite for that. And I don't see it. I mean, certainly I have not seen bills like that filed so far this legislative session. So there has to be some consensus that it's just not the thing to do. Instead, what you're seeing is, you know, the big bipartisan issue right now in the legislature is expanding the postpartum care for Medicaid and for Medicare, you know, here at the state level, because that's just not a protection we have right now. And I think some of these pro-life groups are pushing that instead of the, you know, I don't want to call it vindictive, but instead sort of the looking back legislation and civil lawsuits where we're going to hold women liable, we're going to hold them criminally liable for stuff that happened 10 years ago. I just don't see it happening. And I think that's what, in a very cynical way, Kavanaugh is telling everybody by voting or writing that concurrence and saying, I'm not going farther than this, guys.
Well, challenge flag on the idea that even the smartest law nerds amongst us can understand Montgomery versus Alabama's interpretation of the Teague precedent. But that's a retroactivity question for a different day.
That's another panel.
A decidedly different panel. Andy, curious for your reaction to either the question or anything that Jesus said in response about criminalizing the right to travel or aiding and abetting others who seek abortions in other states, retroactivity concerns. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with Jesus about the what Kavanaugh was doing in that decision. I think that he was signaling, you know, I'm on board for this, but don't expect me to go along with everything else in the future, you know, for to go further. It may seem like I have slavery on the brain today, but it occurs to me that, you know, if you look back at something like the Fugitive Slave Act, you had a time in this country when people could be enslaved in certain states and not in others. And if someone escaped from enslavement in a slave state and went to a state where slavery was illegal, they could still be captured and brought back. And so I think that there's a, you know, it's not entirely impossible that you could imagine a regime in which states try to criminalize or try to penalize people who leave the state to do something that is legal elsewhere when it is not, you know, not illegal in their state. And, you know, the, is it SB 8 in
SB 8 was in Texas. Yep.
Yeah. That, you know, I think if that shows anything, it's how clever people can be, how clever legislators can be in trying to come up with ways around precedent they don't like. And of course, that's something that's, you know, true to both the left and the right. We'll see people, I think, all over the political spectrum coming up with interesting ways around abortion restrictions and also ways to extend the reach of their own state's abortion regime. Because this issue is so polarizing, and we do really have, you know, we think people talk about red states and blue states. I think that's a little over, perhaps overused terminology. But we do have states with very, very strong abortion restrictions, and we have states with very, very strong abortion protections now. It's hard to think of another issue where we have states that are so strongly divided in terms of the extremities of the positions that those states take. Perhaps, you know, going back to slavery, it's really hard to think for me to think of something that has that kind of dichotomy here. So it would not be surprising that states try to come up with ways to do that. I think the pork producers case, depending on the outcome of that, I think offers some, you know, some options there. If you think about a state making it illegal to sell products, for example, that are produced by employees who are paid less than a certain minimum wage, right? I mean, principally, that's no different than the National Pork Producers case, really. It's about restricting sales within a state based on something that happens outside the state. I haven't thought of a clever way that this fits into the abortion paradigm, but people much smarter than I am will think of that, and will have ways, I think, that talk about it. So at the very least, I do think we will see some attempt to expand that right, particularly in states that have you know, super majorities, conservative super majorities. I agree with Jesus that I don't think there's nationally a political will to do this sort of thing now. I've often thought for years that the reversal of Roe v. Wade would be very damaging to Republicans, and I think we have seen actually that, you know, in the last election cycle with the sort of fallout for that. So I think there is kind of a, you know, maybe a limited appetite in places where people still have to win elections that are contested, but in states that have legislatures that are extremely conservative, I think we might see attempts like that. I don't know how far they're going to get nationally. But in some states, I think it'll happen.
Yeah, good. So we have about 5 minutes left. If anyone has a question from the audience, I want to make sure we have a chance to do that. If not, I have one more for our panel in the meantime, and that's about unintended consequences. Do you think we're going to see some unintended consequences of either precedent from these types of legal challenges or very restrictively written laws? For example, the example that comes to mind for me is if you have a personhood law that attaches rights to an embryo at the time of conception, does that have implications for IVF or assisted reproductive technology, the very purpose of which is to create embryos that results in a live birth, the opposite of the outcome you're trying to get when you restrict abortion? So in thinking about this as an originalist and a textualist, if you write a very strict law, are we going to see that there are unintended consequences of that law in other areas? And if so, what might those be? What could that look like? Andy, do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there will be. I mean, we already saw that with the trigger law in Missouri immediately after it went into effect. There were lots of doctors who said, well, I'm not going to do anything to treat a woman with an ectopic pregnancy because I could go to jail based on the way the law is written. You know, so there was some efforts to clarify the law that would, you know, essentially prevent that situation from giving rise to prosecution. But, you know, the Missouri statute with its, you know, the exception for an emergency, that's only an affirmative defense. So you as a doctor, you make the decision about whether something is an emergency. No matter how good faith your decision is, you can still be prosecuted and have to hire a lawyer, go through the whole process of defending yourself and prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that it was an emergency. The burden, the statute places the burden of proof on the doctor. So I think that, you know, definitely is an issue here. IVF is a great example. If you have a situation where in a fertility clinic you have 15, 20, 30 ova that are fertilized, right? Well, now you've got 30 lives. Typically, after you have a successful implantation and a pregnancy, well, what's going to happen to those, you know, those other embryos? Is it murder to let them thaw out, right? I mean, that, certainly it is right now, I think, under Missouri law. That would be my interpretation of the law. So I think we're going to see that. I think there's also all sorts of unintended consequences in terms of whether something like Griswold gets overturned or whether the substantive due process line of cases gets opened back up. So I do think that's something we're going to see as well.
Jesus, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think there are several unintended consequences. And again, I, as an originalist and somebody who has studied the text history and structure of the Due Process Clause and the Supreme Court for a long time, you know, I thought overruling Roe and Casey, like even liberal scholars, Ali Akil Amar and others, have agreed it needed to be done. Now, at this time, was it the right time? Again, Roberts had a separate opinion saying that it should have been done later or done more incrementally, but it's been done. And I think one unintended consequence, I don't know if it's unintended or not, but I mean, there certainly has been a lot of overreaction to Justice Thomas's concurrence. Again, solo concurrence, as a matter of principle, and some folks here in this room have clerked for Justice Thomas. He's a very principled man and a very smart man. But what he's saying is very valid, which is if substantive due process is not a thing, then how can you possibly defend some of these other cases? Now, doesn't mean that they can't be upheld on other grounds. He is an advocate of privileges or immunities. There's other theories that you could potentially bring up as well, potentially. But unfortunately, what it's done is, you know, his concurrence has been used as a straw man or as a target for, you know, the Democrats, certainly in this last congressional session, to pass some very consequential legislation. And one in particular that I think was a result of the concurrence, at least that's what, you know, they were saying it was, is the Respect for Marriage Act, which was passed later this year, I think at the end of November. And essentially, you know, we were sold to it as, you know, essentially codifying Obergefell and trying to protect, you know, Obergefell from being overruled, et cetera, and protecting the right to same-sex marriage, no matter how flawed that foundation is based on substantive due process. But what people don't realize is that, you know, the protections for religious liberty organizations are quite illusory, in my view. You've now weaponized and already weaponized Department of Justice to go after faith-based communities and businesses. And on top of that, you've created a private right of action, civil liability. I mean, we're talking about potentially, you know, going after women for tort actions and whatnot for having an abortion or thinking about getting an abortion. But one unintended consequence is now you have these small business owners and these faith-based organizations who are now faced with civil liability, tens of thousands of dollars, just because they believe in traditional marriage. And again, that was because they set up Thomas's concurrence as a straw man for having to do all this other stuff. So that's the only unfortunate thing I see. I could see a similar thing being done about Lawrence and some of the other cases. Again, you know, another unintended consequence is that, you know, despite raging inflation and despite the issues at the pump and everything else that are hurting these middle class families, you know, a lot of that got, you know, offset by the abortion issue, too. We saw that in Kansas, saw that in November, and Republicans didn't do as well. So I don't take a position on that one way or the other, at least in this capacity. But that was certainly another unintended consequence. And I think as we move forward in the legislature, so what we're going to propose, we need to think about very seriously, what legislation is going to advance the ball, not only from a normative standpoint, but also from a legal standpoint that the courts are going to uphold.
Andy, anything you'd like to respond to? Or
The only other thing that occurred to me was, you know, I think at least from the perspective of abortion rights advocates, the doomsday scenario is that the 14th Amendment's due process clause gets extended to life at conception, which is not currently the state of the law, but that is something that could certainly happen, and which, you know, turns this paradigm on its head, I think, somewhat. In fact, I, if something like that would happen, I'd be very curious to see the Federalist Society's position on that. For example, if you'd have federal courts legislating from the bench on that issue, you know, what would be the outcome in traditional left and right-leaning organizations? Would you see a kind of flip of perspectives there? I think that's a really interesting thing we're going to see. But
I look forward to inviting you back for that debate when that happens. So I think the conclusion I've drawn from our panel today is that notwithstanding that Justice Alito's opinion in Dobbs is monumental and rewrites the textbooks for constitutional law students across the country in really important ways, it's really only the beginning of our nationwide discussion about whether and to what extent we should allow the restriction of abortion services. So I would be curious to know what a panel like this might say in 5 years once we've seen some of these cases proceed to trial and to appellate courts and to watch the law develop.
And I just want to, you know, This is unrelated, but I just want to thank Andy for being here because, you know, as some of us have talked about last night, we've had a really hard time finding the alternative to our debates and our discussions. So I really appreciate you and Kelly being here to do this because I think it makes the discussion a lot better. And you've done this twice now, so I hope we can count on you again to come back and speak to us.
Always happy to be here.
And I hope the message is that we truly do believe in free and open debate at the Federalist Society. So those of you who are watching the recording or watching this in the future, please say yes when you're invited to participate on panels. We promise to make sure all voices are heard. That's the idea. So thank you to both of our panelists.
Thank you.